do.
Hecabe tightened the fist of the Sharkoi around the fallen one and unleashed them with his thought. They moved deliberately toward their injured brother and started to kick it as it held its clawed fists up, begging for mercy. A Nexus watched as they stomped the creature until the head tore free and rolled across the ground. The decapitated body of the Sharkoi stopped quivering. Hecabe focused his attention on five ships as they took off. They wobbled for a moment as they rose, likely controlled by Jirohanai, barely able to adapt to human controls. After a moment, they corrected their ascent and flew out north over the desert. They would trace search patterns across the wasteland until they found the Sangheili ships that had managed to survive the fight in orbit. Then, they would disgorge Sharkoi and kill them all. A Nexus watched them depart. "We should send word to our fellow Jirohanai clans. We could even call the Banished to us. Atriox would send us cruisers to transport these Sharkoi back to our homeworld. We will be safe forever, just as we planned. The Jirohanai will no longer suffer when all see our new weapon." "No." Hecabe looked out from Sharkoi senses spread throughout the city, seeing humans moving to aim missiles down at the crater from the top of a building. He burst out at them, shouldering through the stairwell that he barely fit in, smashing walls apart to break free, and they screamed and scattered before his Sharkoi frame. He impaled them on his claws and threw each of them down to the street, bellowing from the rooftop in victory. "We will truly make certain we are safe from our enemies forever, but we will do it on our own. We do not need the other Jirohanai, and we do not need the Banished. All that we need is already here." The wind in his mind had hinted at its power before, but it became more and more clear to Hecabe as the Jirohanai controlled human ships, filled with Sharkoi in their hangar bays, moved farther away from the city. The Forerunner device that had embedded itself into his skull had more reach than he had even imagined. It could operate on far more than just a world. It could reach light years across into other distant places. The only constraint was the strength of his own mind. "Chieftain, we will need a carrier large enough to transport the Sharkoi," a Nexus insisted. "We will not cower and beg for assistance," Hecabe shouted at him. "We will not hole up on our own worlds and wait to take abuse. Instead, we shall seize what we have here and go to our enemies. We will strike them down on their own worlds. We will reduce them to nothing but ghosts and shadows." "And how will we go to them?" the Nexus asked, frustration rolling off him. "We have only a handful of weak human ships." Hecabe pointed west. "There are Sangheili on the ground repairing their cruisers even as we speak, thinking that they will take us by surprise. They are sorely mistaken. The Sangheili cruisers will be ours soon enough. Our strength will prevail." "But what if they're not repaired in time? What if—" A Nexus screamed as two of the Sharkoi nearby unceremoniously grabbed each of his arms and pulled. The limbs tore free like petals from a flower, his flesh ripping and joints popping free as the Sharkoi casually flung the torn appendages aside. A Nexus dropped to his knees in front of Hecabe. "Mercy," he frothed, blood pouring from his destroyed shoulders. "There is no more mercy," Hecabe said as the Sharkoi standing directly behind a nexus picked him up. If the Sangheili vessels fail me, then there will be human ships that arrive here soon. I will take what is due to me, one way or another. The Sharkoi simply crumpled a nexus in its giant fists, like balling up a piece of trash. Hecabe could feel ribs shatter and poke at his palms. Everything here would be his. Everything. And once he sat on the ruins of all this planet had to offer, other worlds would feel his wrath. Safety and respect were no longer his goal. Dominion was what he now sought. There would be a true Jirohanai Empire to rival even the Covenant. An empire ruled by him. And Hecabe solemnly promised himself it would be unlike anything the stars had ever seen.
Chapter 19. A pelican flanked by two smaller Sparrowhawk gunships cut through the air just above Soraka's skyline, banking hard as they approached the fighting. Sorakan militia had fallen back almost 8 blocks from the crater. The gray tide of Sharkoi was implacable, plowing into the city's defenders and leaving only a trail of carnage behind. "It's a damn massacre," Sergeant Carson said, looking out over the pilot's shoulder. Jai agreed. But in order for them to have a chance at stopping this, they needed the Sharkoi and their Jirohanai leader, the chieftain by the name of Hecabe, preoccupied. So rather than retreat, the militia kept on fighting. "Where to?" Jai asked Adriana as the pelican looped around again, avoiding stray fire that came from a battle raging above the desert.
"We won't be able to stay up in the middle of this for much longer," the pilot shouted.
Soraka had thrown almost every flying vehicle they could get into the air in order to harass and distract the vessels that the Sharkoi had taken. Melody believed that Hecabe's strategy, now that his cruiser had been destroyed, would be to secure vessels in order to carry the Sharkoi off-world. Transmissions from the bridges of these ships confirmed that Jirohanai now had control and were moving the stolen vessels deeper into the desert, for reasons yet to be made clear. Sorakan aircraft had assaulted them en masse. Pelican gunships, Sparrowhawks, and even some effectively armed Nightingales had initiated the strike. But the aircraft over the crater, completely outmatched in firepower, were being shot down by the Sorakan's own point defense weapons on the brute-controlled ships. The distraction wasn't going to last too long. The Sorakans were paying a high price to get this team into position. Jai glanced out of the pelican's rear bay to the left to see a phantom keeping pace with them and in perfect formation, lazily swooping and twisting to match the human pilot's evasive maneuvers, providing protection for this effort. "How strange it feels to be flying into combat with an old enemy beside us," Jai thought. Rajka Kassan had not said a word when he'd joined them in the staging area with the envoy by his side. Although everyone present seemed at ease with a Sangheili holding conversation in the same room as them, Jai found it rather challenging. It must have been tough for the rest of Grey Team, too. Most of the people here had grown accustomed to human Sangheili relations since the war had ended 6 years ago, despite all that was happening on Kero. But for Grey Team, the war had ended only hours earlier. It was difficult to keep instincts trained for years in check, instincts that told him to kill and protect at the sight of the enemy. Rajka, for his part, did not seem to mind, though he was virtually impossible to read, especially in a neutral posture, something Jai had rarely ever seen from an elite. The Sangheili had just stood most silent as the envoy explained they were here to help take out Hecabe. But there was still the matter of Gliki, which pretty much guaranteed that no matter what he looked like, this Sangheili was anything but neutral.
The technology used to control the Sharkoi is tied to a single individual. We all know that much, Melody had told the Sarakan generals, boosting their plan. So we target the chieftain, Hecabe. That's the best chance we have to slow or stop this mess. The Sangheili with Rajka had been visibly uncomfortable. Jai and the rest of Grey Team remained on the other side of the governor and envoy, giving the Sangheili their space. They'd pooled their arsenals to start this last-ditch attack, a unified strategy that had to work if there was any chance to stop Hecabe. The Spartans would take a pelican, and the Sangheili would take a phantom. War, Jai thought, makes for strange, shifting allegiances. There, Adriana now said, pointing to the top of a building. Our line of sight is good there. That's right on the line, the pilot warned. We don't know how long we can hold them back before they overrun us.
If what Azikiwe says is true, all I need is one good shot and this is over, Adriana said.
She made her way to the side compartment of the Pelican's rear bay and retrieved the SRS-99S5AM sniper rifle provided by the Sarakans. And I'm far, far better than just a good shot.
That's right over the edge of that rifle's range, Sergeant Carson observed.
One good shot, Adriana repeated slowly. Let's go. We're wasting time that no one has to spend.
Set us down, Jai said to the pilot, grabbing an M392 designated marksman rifle from the wall mount and fixing it magnetically to his back. The pelican swooped around and dropped down onto the roof. Mike, Jai, and Adriana leapt out, followed by Sergeant Carson and her squad.
If we're overrun, Jai shouted inside the bird, don't try to come back for us. We'll make our own way out.
Yes, sir,
the pilot called back. The pelican roared into the air. As it spiraled away, a large bolt of plasma fire from the crater struck its tail, immediately killing one of its engines. It spun around in an uncontrolled dive and crashed between buildings several blocks away. Carson's squad stared at the dying pelican. But Jai needed them to focus.
Get into the stairwells, he ordered. Make sure nothing gets up to the roof.
The squad scuttled into motion, Carson leading the way.
We'll mind the stairs, she shouted back at them, ducking through the door. It'll slow them down even if they do get past the line.
The three Spartans stood together for a moment of silence, then turned to look at the phantom circling the building around them like a buzzard.
You know, if the Sangheili lied to the envoy, Adriana said, nodding toward the gunship, then they're probably going to ambush us now. This roof is just as good a place as any for them to try to take their revenge. An enraged Kaidan, bitter at the destruction of his homeworld because of their actions. If he chose to attack, there was little Grey Team could do to stop them. But the Phantom stopped wheeling about and landed on a neighboring building, deploying Rajka and eight of his fellow Sangheili.
They're not joining us on this building, Mike said.
Did you think they would literally stand shoulder to shoulder with us? Adriana asked.
No. I guess this makes sense, Jai said.
They agreed to carry comms so that the envoy can reach them for us, Mike said. That's pretty damn close to shoulder to shoulder.
I can't imagine that they'd be inclined to do much more than stand by if one of those creatures caught up to us, Jai said. But maybe I'm wrong about them.
As Adriana quickly set up her rifle, Rajka walked to the edge of the opposite building and looked across the gulf at the Spartans. Jai cautiously faced him as well. Then Rajka solemnly turned, his Sangheili falling in with him, and disappeared down the building's stairwell.
What was that all about? Jai asked.
We who are about to die salute you, Adriana said, extending the sniper rifle's tripod. Those of us who are also doing something really risky salute you right back.
Adriana set up the rifle on the edge where she could lie prone and take in all of the vast crater. She began scanning for their target.
Mike, spot?
Jai was already heading down the stairwell.
I'll spot, Mike said, checking the sights on a modified Sarakan MA-37 assault rifle.
But where are you going? Helping our Sorakin friends out, Chai said. He hopped down from stairwell to make time, slamming into the metal floors and denting them when he landed. He found an area with a broken window looking out on the intersection. The crossroad was packed with sandbags, and missile pods fired down the street toward the Sharkoi. The massive creatures never stopped pressing forward despite the constant fire. All firepower could do was contain them. One Sharkoi would die and another would appear around the corner, climbing over the bodies of its own kind for an opportunity to attack the Sorakins. Jai smashed the rest of the windowpane out and set the bipod of the DMR on the edge. It didn't have the range of Adriana's sniper rifle, but with the custom high-explosive ammo the Sorakins used, it would do well enough at this range. He looked down through the scope. He made a tiny adjustment to find one Sharkoi lumbering up the street, shrugging off gunfire. Jai moved his aim up to the creature's strange head atop its broad, muscled shoulders. He focused on the large lump on its forehead. He wasn't sure if it helped it see or connected it to the chieftain. Either way, it looked vital. Jai held his breath. He slightly increased the pressure on his index finger until the rifle fired. The tissue on the giant's head vaporized and Jai started breathing again. The Sharkoi stumbled and landed on its hands and knees. It crawled forward at the sandbags as blood gushed from its head onto the road. Jai reloaded, listening to Mike calling out to Sorakin militia for a sighting of the Jerohanai chieftain over the channel. The Sorakins had now withdrawn their aircraft, but militia hiding in buildings behind the lines or with sight lines on the crater constantly reported in, tracking enemy movements in the city and in the crater.
The Jerohanai we're after. He's the one without a helmet. He has shards of something sticking out of his skull.
Looks forerunner, Adriana said. Yes? Melody's voice crackled in their ears, patched in from the operations center.
Yes, that's our guy. The technology. It's a neural reader of some sort. Very invasive, and Oni theories say it might even have melded with his entire brain cavity by now.
Jai reloaded, got a bead on the crawling Sharkoi, bleeding out. Five of them had battled through the last barrage of missiles, RPGs, and a near-constant hail of gunfire, just to get within reach of the Sorakin barricade down by the first floor of their building. One was down, four remained. Jai fired and watched the shot hit the next Sharkoi in the side of its head. An RPG struck it a second later, sending it to the ground in a heap. It finally stopped moving.
The Jirohanai chieftain is wandering into my sightline, Adriana said. Send visual through the closed comm. Can I get a confirmation on the target?
Confirmed, Melody said.
Three surviving Sharkoi moved at an alarming pace and crashed into the Sorakins as the crossroads below erupted in the chaos of close quarters fighting. Chai hefted the DMR and tried to find a shot, but couldn't at this angle. The Sharkoi rampaged through until nothing recognizable of the human defenders remained.
One of the Sharkoi now stopped, its head slowly turning until it seemed to look up at the window toward Jai with that strange socket in its head.
Melody half jumped as the vice governor tapped her on the shoulder. She'd been leaning in to answer Adriana 111's question. Screens showed grainy feeds from militia shoulder cameras scattered all over the city, but she was focused only on the feed the Spartan had patched through from her heads-up display. The vice governor looked concerned.
What happens after the kill? He asked.
Melody glanced back at the video. She'd told Adriana she was clear to take out the chieftain, but she could see that Hecabe was roaming past rubble along the crater's edge, moving in and out of her sightline. Adriana seemed to be waiting for a perfect moment. Melody could feel every heartbeat inside her own chest.
I don't know, Vice Governor, she admitted.
The Sharkoi will no longer be under Hecabe's control, but they will likely still pose some kind of threat. We have little information as it is, and Oni said nothing about how they would function outside of the control mechanism the Forerunners implanted.
Please call me Lamar, he said. So this undirected chaos.
Theoretically, we could fall back and engage as needed, right?
These are all just best guesses, Vice.
She stopped and corrected herself.
Lamar, it's all theory.
Whatever it is, it will be significantly more manageable than what you're currently facing. Governor Gass tapped a screen showing a distant feed of Hecabe as a tiny dot walking around the far side of the crater's rim, likely from a patrolling drone.
When he drops, we need to get to that thing from his head before someone else does.
There is a fast response shock team standing by with orders, said Lamar. They'll jump Jed out of a Nightingale to the spot. It should get them there faster than anything else we have. I also have squads on the ground to provide cover and rush there if necessary.
Melody gave them both a dubious look.
The Spartans aren't going to take that thing.
Governor Gass gave her a similarly impatient look.
We can't make any assumptions. You told us Gray Team has been behind enemy lines in Cryo for the last 6 years. How am I supposed to believe they won't? We have Sang Healy here, hailing from the same group that started this mess to begin with. I don't truly know what they're doing here either, or what their motivations are.
Or yours, her eyes accused Melody. The governor looked frayed, intense, and full of anger. The war had taken a toll on her. Melody needed to be very careful here.
I am telling you everything I know, Melody said reassuringly. I am trying to help. So is Gray Team.
And yet, the governor said, we are only just now learning about these things.
You've kept many secrets from us. Those are my people dying out there, Envoy. It could have been prevented. The blood here is on the UNSC. All we wanted was our own peace.
Hello? Adriana murmured over the speaker. We have a good shot. I'm taking it.
Everyone stopped talking and watched the screens. Rajka's active camouflage faded away. His fighters hung off the sides of the alley. Their fingertips dug into window ledges, looking down at him from high above as he approached one of the Sharkoi standing near the entrance. They had worked their way down through the human building to a level with access to the outside. Clambering down the exterior walls, Rajka reached the ground first and signaled for his soldiers to remain where they clung, while he approached the street outside the alley. Rajka was here to study this new threat, to learn how to fight it. If he died here, they would at least leave with information about how to attack one of these creatures. This Sharkoi threw sandbags at the retreating humans in the street. Vehicles and debris were strewn around it. Preoccupied with the humans before it, it had its back to the Sang Healy. Another Sharkoi several meters away destroyed the missile pod the humans had operated, slamming it to the ground until small pieces fell from its clawed fists. Every impact had shaken the street like a gravity hammer, causing pieces of metal to ricochet off the sides of buildings. The Sharkoi nearest to Rajka finally turned and noticed him. The lump of flesh in the bony forehead vibrated intensely. Some sort of echolocation, Rajka realized. Not an eye, but it served the same purpose.
Rafka!
The creature roared below its jagged teeth, surprising the Sangheili.
Hecabe, Rajka said.
He had never met the Jerahani chieftain before, but the chieftain apparently knew of him, thanks to Thars.
You will all die.
The Sharkoi said in a guttural voice, speaking Hecabe's words.
I will hunt you all down. Then I will go to your keep and destroy all that you built here until your bloodline is gone forever.
Rajka activated his energy sword, the blue light of the contained plasma reflecting off the walls. He realized then that dying in a human alley was not the glorious death he had thought to attain, but he would meet this new challenge with everything at his disposal nonetheless. The Sharkoi thudded forward, shoulders brushing the sides of the buildings. The creature was over 5 meters at full height, so Rajka had an advantage keeping in between these tightly spaced human structures. He could move with ease, but this creature would be limited by its size. Rajka tensed as the beast closed to within meters. He would need all his speed to dodge those wicked claws, but if he could get up near that thick neck... The distinct sound of a single high-powered human sniper rifle's shot cracked from the rooftop above. Another thudding step. This was it. The Sharkoi stumbled, however, and shook its head in confusion. Instead of running forward, Rajka took the creature's new motion in stride and stepped back so he could continue observing. Had the demons actually done it? The Sharkoi's head leaned back, as if trying to comprehend the sky above it. It grumbled under its breath, and then pushed against the walls, turning back toward the street. "Fleetmaster, the Spartan has taken the shot," the envoy confirmed, her voice crackling loudly from the small communications device she'd clipped to Rajka's harness. The Sharkoi startled slightly and turned its head back down into the alley at the sound of the words. The thrum of echolocation filled the area, bouncing down the narrow human corridor. It made another rumbling in its throat. Seemingly confused, the air vibrated again as Rajka shifted his position, and the body language of the creature changed. The muscles in its great thighs bunched, and the Sharkoi bellowed. Behind it, beyond its great legs, Rajka saw the other Sharkoi milling around on the road. They were wandering about with an aimless curiosity. Bullets struck them without warning. They swung their attention back toward the human militia down the street from them and charged. "The creatures are attacking again," Daga shouted from his vantage above. "Assist the human warriors," Rajka ordered. The Sharkoi in front of Rajka bellowed again, edging closer to the Sangheili. This was the moment of truth. Although a thinking being, these creatures no longer seemed connected to Hecabe. Will it attack? Is it aggressive by nature? Rajka deactivated his sword and backed away, as if trying to calm a wild animal. "See, I am no threat," he said softly. The Sharkoi thudded into motion, lunging toward him with impressive speed. It stabbed at him with one set of claws. But Rajka rolled out of the way. The Sharkoi was still quick, but it lacked the strategic intellect. It acted now only on instinct and anger. Rajka activated his sword just as the impact of the Sharkoi slammed into him like a massive ocean wave, and they both burst through the alley wall in a cloud of debris. Chapter 20. Hecabe fell back and his head bounced off a hard slab of concrete. It felt like he had been slammed in the face by a gravity hammer. Then he became immediately aware of being disconnected from the device in his head. He was dwelling only in his own limited mind once more. He felt naked, small, insignificant. Sniper. It had to be a sniper. He had heard the shot through other senses. He had seen the trail the bullet left in the air leading back to a building near. His thoughts scattered and came back together. The Sangheili Fleetmaster, Rajka. He had spoken to Rajka. He had seen himself fall backward, blood splattering around him. His blood. Now, he lay still. But he wasn't dead yet. He was still thinking. And he was in pain. He should be dead by all rights. He writhed on his back, hardly able to stand the burning in his left eye. He could feel the warmth of the blood seeping down the back of his skull. Then he felt something else. A cold sliver of metal slipped around his forehead once again, this time on its own, and dug under his skin, scraping tendrils against the bone of his skull. The shot had injured him grievously, but this ancient machine somehow survived. The pieces of the mysterious object that he carried so far to this world
that had burrowed inside him, now wriggled and crawled even further down through his scalp. It penetrated even deeper than before. Hecabe could sense the Forerunner device actively seek out the damage and seal it off, doing its best to repair the chunks of his missing flesh and stop the bleeding. The same technology that could weld itself to his neural tissue to control the Sharkoi could apparently also hold it together when damaged. He must have lost brain matter with that impact. Excruciating pain welled up where his left eye once was, but the rest of the Sharkoi network now moved to compensate. Hecabe felt that pieces of his own mind had spread out through the implants in the Sharkoi's minds, and that the part of himself that he had deposited with each Sharkoi now returned back to him, igniting the ancient connection again. Hecabe could feel his own essence pouring back out into the network of Sharkoi. He had control of it all once more. Hecabe looked down at himself. Four Sharkoi surrounded him, their bodies creating an effective shield of hardened gray flesh, blocking any potential threats. Hecabe peered at himself through their eyes to see the horrible gaping hole in his left eye and the shattered bone around it. It all now glittered with Forerunner metal, holding his empty eye socket in place. It had shoved small fragments of itself throughout the bullet damage and fused Hecabe's skull back together. Hecabe grabbed the arm of the nearest Sharkoi, and leaning on Oath of Fury, he pulled himself to his feet. The pain began to drift away from him. Three Jirohanai had run up the side of the crater to see if their chieftain was still alive. Now they backed away from him, eyes wide with shock.
"Do you see?" Hecabe shouted. "Do you now see the power I wield? I cannot be killed."
Hecabe closed his good eye to focus. Through his extended presence, he could feel the distant tickle of that other information deep inside the network. The wind. Some kind of ghost in the great biological spider web, with Hecabe at its center. Maybe this was how it always functioned, the Forerunner machine engulfing one's mind into it, and then distributing it all around so that he could survive. Could it be that something else lived in here with him?
"No,"
the distant voice inside told him.
"You alone wear the vertex."
The vertex? Was that what they had once called this machine? Hecabe wondered if the voice was some kind of thinking machine that assisted any who wore the device. It wasn't like that, though. There were strata. The echoes of another mind that once controlled all this had somehow remained behind in the vast deep that connected him with the Sharkoi. These things, in this place, could now become a part of him. But he was still the central power. The controller. He was not immortal. He was just that much harder to kill. And if he died, parts of him would still live on in this deep place. Hecabe, shielded by Sharkoi, turned and walked down the side of the crater. There was still so much more power to understand here, Hecabe realized. But it was time to ensconce himself in a safe area and barricade the doors. He would have the Sharkoi he released continue the work he had given them. It was also time, Hecabe thought, to release the Sharkoi that still remained in stasis below. He had been unsure of how many he could control with his will at any given time. But now he saw that he had underestimated the humans. They were indeed clever. But this injury would be the extent of their victory. He would lay hold of the Sangheili ships on the far side of the desert and redouble his efforts against the wretched human city, tearing it to the ground one stone at a time. He would flood the planet with Sharkoi and rid it of human and Sangheili meddlers forever.
He would make them all suffer.
Rajka pulled his energy sword out of the Sharkoi's neck and struggled out from underneath its bulk. Debris shifted, and a section of wall slumped down to the floor, crumbling across the dead giant's frame. He coughed as the gray dust swirled around him. A cracked rib made him wince. Every bruised muscle screamed as he limped forward in the lobby of the Sorakan building, the same one upon which the Spartans had landed. Rajka! It was Melody's voice, warbling slightly. The human communications device was cracked open, but somehow still working. We show movement from your location. Respond.
Yes, Envoy. I am here.
Rajka leaned against the railing, taking a moment to control his pain. The Sharkoi had overwhelmed him, exploding them into the bottom of the human building. Although intended to be a killing blow, the Sharkoi's attack allowed Rajka the opportunity to force the hilt of his sword into its neck. As the building had fallen onto them, a twist of his arm severed the creature's head from its body. Rajka had woken with a start and struggled to claw free of the debris many long moments later.
A message from Sergeant Carson. She flew in with the Spartans.
You should fall back to the roof, Melody said in a hurried Sangheili. Carson has mined the stairs, and her team is about to detonate them. There are more Sharkoi coming. You've got about 40 seconds before they get to you.
What about his Sangheili warriors?
Rajka limped through the ruined wall back into the alleyway. He had last seen them leaping for the street to fight alongside the humans. Rajka stared at the street where his fighters lay lifeless, scattered in awkward, unmoving poses throughout the area next to their human counterparts, their bodies destroyed together, smashed by the force of Sharkoi fists.
Dagger!
Rajka shouted. He stumbled out of the shadow of the alleyway.
I'm sorry. They fought bravely, Melody said.
Dagger!
Rajka could see three Sharkoi dead. The humans and his warriors must have fought fiercely. Blood dripped from walls, plasma and bullet scars marking every open space.
You need to move quickly, Melody said.
More Sharkoi are coming. You've got 30 seconds. Rajka could see where four humans and Dagger had made a final stand. He had to get one step closer to see the details. He would be responsible for witnessing and conveying to his clan Dagger's final act of heroism in battle. Rajka felt shaking under his feet.
I heard you say that the Spartans shot Hecabe, Rajka said.
He had seen the Sharkoi that attacked him in the alley appear to lose contact after Hecabe had spoken through it. One moment it had recognized him. The next it moved like a wild beast, completely on its own.
You humans thought this would end the conflict. What is happening now?
We are not really sure. Get upstairs, Rajka. There's a pelican coming in. You only have 20 seconds before they trigger the mines.
Rajka left the street for the lobby of the building. He scanned the lower floor and found the stairwell, seemingly large enough for a Sharkoi to breach in the far corner. He ran through the demolished interior, past the giant creature he had killed, and clambered up the stairs as quickly as he could manage. It hurt, and he had to use the railing to pull himself along, but his anger carried him past his pain. Dagger had been by his side since they had hatched. They had fought in the sands of their keeps by their uncles. They had refurbished the greatest ships of the Covenant together.
They had fought together.
And they had stood together against Thars.
Gone.
A team of four small humans looked down from one of the intervening floors and waved him on, gesturing at him to keep going further up the stairs. Rajka groaned, but pressed on, taking the remainder in one last bound, passing the humans as he neared the rooftop. Rajka paused for a moment and leaned his head against the wall.
overcome by anger and pain from his pulverized body, when a series of booms sent shockwaves through the air and the whole stairwell shook. The explosives blew dust and fire up the well, knocking Rajka to his side. He leaned over the edge and looked down from the floor he had reached. The large system of stairs below him had disappeared in a haze of roiling smoke, the exterior wall collapsing to reveal the alley outside. "Humans," he called out in a broken version of their language. One of them stepped out from behind a pillar and looked up at him from across the destroyed gap. They had survived a few floors below. This was part of a strategy. She shouted, pointing up. Rajka stared at them. They had trapped themselves on the lower floor and were now going to try and hold off the Sharkoi, while he left for safety. "No." Rajka limped around to join them. "We will all make this stand," he thought. He would die, just like his own Sangheili. A Sharkoi slammed through the pillar at the bottom of the structure, the main support system for what remained of their side of the building. The human spun around and opened fire without even blinking. Two rocket-propelled explosives slammed into the creature from the side as the rest of the human squad moved quickly to attack it. But two more of the creatures burst in through the walls below, ripping out the column and sending the remainder of that side of the building to the ground. The humans fell into a blossom of dust and debris several floors below. Even if they survived the fall, they would all die in seconds. The Sharkoi would not spare them. More of the stairs crumbled and fell down to the floor below. Rajka backed up to the wall and felt a hard tug on his arm. He turned and froze, finding himself face to face with a Spartan.
"One of the Grey Team."
"I heard the explosions," the Spartan said through a translation device. The demon spoke Sangheili. A benefit of the comms technology the humans no doubt used for their behind-the-lines activities during the war. "We leave. Now." Rajka grabbed the Spartan's elbow and let him pull him along as they ran up the stairs. A Sharkoi below them bellowed at their escape. The Spartan leaned over and looked down. "They can climb walls," he reported. "Let's move faster."
"Did you not kill the Jirohanai?" Rajka asked.
They spiraled up another floor's worth of stairs. "We thought we got him." "It was a good shot," the Spartan said.
"So what happened?" Rajka asked.
"It didn't kill him. The chieftain stood back up and now the Sharkoi move with him in control again." They broke out of the stairwell and onto the open roof. One of their angular dropships waited for them, their independently maneuvering lift engines blowing dust off the deck and onto Rajka's legs as it pivoted into position.
"How is that possible?" Rajka shouted.
"I don't know. We'll have to figure out how to kill him better next time." Two more Spartans from the Grey Team fell in on either side of Rajka. They all piled into the Pelican as a Sharkoi burst out of and through the stairwell behind them, debris flying everywhere. One of the Spartans swung behind a large machine gun mounted on the rear bay of the Pelican and opened fire as the transport took off. The Sharkoi ignored the flak and jumped at them, launching through the air at incredible speed. Rajka snapped his energy sword on and waited for the impact. A human sniper rifle cracked twice, just above his right shoulder. Rajka's hearing cut out and his head rang, but the Sharkoi's head got the worst of it. It snapped back and exploded in a burst of viscera. Its gnarled hands narrowly missed the edge of the ramp, and it plummeted down lifeless to the street below. Rajka deactivated the energy sword and leaned back against the inside of the Pelican, grabbing a handhold.
"I would now think we have made Hecabe much more wrathful than he was before this effort," he said to the Spartans. "The Demon Three." The one who had saved his life turned to look at Rajka, and then nodded.
"Agreed," he said.
Lamar intercepted Elise just outside her office and deftly steered her back inside. She tried to spin away, clearly annoyed. but Lamar just as deftly blocked the attempt.
"A moment, Governor," he said, while closing the door behind him.
"Lamar, we spent a significant amount of time lacing the crater with explosives. We need to use them. We need to fire the trap."
Elise shook her head. She'd already thought about this and looked at the situation, as well as a number of possibilities, including using the 4 merchant ships that remained in orbit and even jettisoning more space debris, none of them plausible given the circumstance.
"The militia have fallen 9 blocks back from the mines your people laid. They won't be able to cross that to try and retake it. There are too many of those things out loose in the streets. This isn't about retaking it. We need to slow down the flow of the Sharkoi still coming out of the structure. We need to buy ourselves time to get away, or at least fall further back. We still have those ships. They can take people."
A spike of anger surged through her.
"We are not falling back, Lamar."
"Soraka is lost, Elise."
"No."
Elise swept everything off her desk with shaking hands.
"No!"
Lamar took a step back.
"Elise, it's true."
She closed her eyes, unwilling to look at him.
My son died here to protect this city. So many others did too in just a few short days, Lamar. What was all that for? Our plans. My plans. My leadership. Their blood.
The planning done by the generals. What was it for?
Tell me that, goddammit!
Lamar leaned forward, hands on the now empty desk. "When I was in officer training, the instructor told us about one of the ancient battles back on Earth, a battle that the Athenians had with the Persians.
Now is not the time for anecdotes, Lamar.
Those who don't know history are forever doomed to repeat it," Lamar said. "So the Persians attacked the city of Athens. It stood for everything the Athenians were, contained all their great buildings and their culture. No doubt many patriotic leaders swore to resist the Persians at any cost, to the last dying warrior. But instead, the Athenians built boats and took to the sea en masse, abandoning their city to be burned and looted by the Persians. After the frustrated Persians left, the Athenians just sailed back in."
Elise opened her eyes. "You're suggesting we do the same? Just walk away?"
Lamar nodded. "The Athenians had an epiphany. They knew that they just couldn't match the Persian might on land. They also knew that a city isn't just a place, Elise. Nor is it just a collection of buildings, or even land. The true heart is its people. Protect a city's people, and you protect the essence of it.
Governor, we need to protect our citizens, not a patch of dirt or what's built on it. Those are just things that time will see erased. We need to see the big picture here.
Lamar, we have lost Soraka before and come back. This isn't new territory for these folks. And we will come back again. But only if we save our people first."
"Did the Athenians have to deal with neurally linked alien monsters?" Elise asked.
"No." Lamar smiled sadly. "In fact, the Persians may have had a civilization more recognizable to us today than the Athenians. But the strategic principles still stand, Governor.
This isn't our war, Elise. This is a UNSC problem. It's just in our backyard. We should just let them deal with it and come back when things return to normal."
Elise sighed and gave him a haunted look.
"Jeff died here, Lamar."
"I know, Elise." She gave a small frown, then said,
"Okay. Okay, do it. We abandon the city."
"You need to give the order, not me," Lamar said. He guided her by the elbow toward the door.
"Come on."
Elise blinked as they crossed through the ops room to where General Kapoor and General Grace waited expectantly. Elise gripped the edge of a panel and gathered strength from deep inside.
"Blow the mines," she said. "Evacuate the city."
Kapoor had the orders already pulled up. He presented them to the governor for a thumbprint. That triggered a sudden burst of activity inside the bunker. New video feeds flashed up. Aides scurried around. Officers began murmuring commands. Drones flying at a high altitude focused in on the perimeter of the crater, where the vice governor's thermobaric bombs had been hidden. Melody Azikiwe moved through the throng toward Elise.
"Governor, what's happening?"
Elise pointed to the cluster of central view screens.
"You just watch, Envoy. Any moment now."
Melody turned. The feeds of the crater flickered, and then the ground along the rim abruptly sank and crumpled in on itself. A split second later, a geyser of dirt fountained into the air. The explosions continued around the rim, like high-grade mining demolitions. They looked small and inconsequential from the screens, but having been there firsthand, Elise knew the area of effect was significant. Dust rushed toward the nearest cameras and knocked them out, leaving nothing but static on the view screens. An aide in the corner clapped once, twice, and then stopped. Lamar turned away from the screens.
"This isn't a win, people," he said loudly. "This is just a distraction to buy us some time. Now we need to evacuate every civilian we can. Send them to the oases. Herndon Lake, Azah Oasis, Fallen Tree. There's water and shelter in those places. Any valley in the mountains with a stream. Any waypoint out in the Ult with a supply of water. We need to get them out of here and to safety."
"What about the four ships still in orbit?" Kapoor asked.
"Should we use those to engage the Sharkor, or to evacuate more people?"
"I vote to keep them up and in orbit," Lamar said, turning to Elise. "If we call them down, we risk turning them over to the enemy, or at the very least, attracting them to our evacuation efforts. Right now, we can take people through the underground passages to the trading outposts, and move out from there on foot. That's the safest."
"I concur. If we need the ships, they'll be on hand. The vice governor is going to be directing this effort," Elise said. "Take your orders from him." "These won't stop Hecabe," Melody said separately. "I know."
Elise pivoted to face her.
"Apparently we needed nukes for that, something the UNSC obviously doesn't trust us with. We could have rigged the ships, but they were hijacked, and the others would be too risky to bring in at this point. We're going to evacuate and let the UNSC come here to clean up their own mess."
"What about our power source?" Grace asked, phrasing it carefully.
"Power source?" Melody pressed. Elise sighed. What did secrets matter at this point?
"We have just one repurposed Havoc bomb running emergency power to this bunker."
"You have an illegal nuclear weapon?"
Melody asked, visibly shocked.
"Yes."
"Are we going to argue about secret keeping?" Elise snapped back, annoyed. "I'll check the score and see where Oni places. But before you get any ideas, it's ours, and I've already made plans for it. So no, Oni cannot have more of our material."
Melody smiled awkwardly.
"I'm only asking questions, so I understand our situation," she said, raising her hands. "I want to talk about the bigger picture, like containment.
We need to make sure there's no way the Sharkoi can get off the planet."
Elise experienced chills as she realized the envoy was effectively writing Soraka off. What was one city in the panoply of worlds under the unified Earth government's thumb after all?
"You're worried about Earth right now? Is that it?
When a million of us are wondering if there's going to be a tomorrow?"
Melody remained calm, yet stern.
"Yes, actually.
If you are evacuating out of the city to Havens, then your problems are almost over. Everyone else's are just getting started. Hecabe's not going to stop with Soraka or Rak or anything else on Kero. He's going to leave this place, and I want to stop him. Now, I was told none of those ships the Sharkoi took with the Jiro Hanai are capable of slipspace travel. Is that true? Your hingehead friends destroyed all my ships with drives when the fighting broke out. Remember? When we began making plans for your peace summit and everything went to hell? Elise's voice was cold. So if you're worried about slipspace, go talk to the Sangheili and leave us alone. Melody said carefully, Maybe I can get Rajka to try to open communications with Tharz, if he is still alive. Or Tharz's people, if he isn't. It's possible his people know about the Sharkoi at this point. Maybe they'd even be willing to work with us. I want to find solutions, Governor. Elise grimaced. Enough with the UNSC's solutions. Hadn't they already cost enough lives? She looked over at the new team working their way into the bunker. Specialists that she'd called for to help her work on new ideas for saving the city with one last effort. Rhodes, over here, she called. Elise's lead nuclear engineer, Brandon Rhodes, saw her and acknowledged with a wave. Governor, I have the whole team assembled and ready. Excellent, let's get started, shall we? She said to Rhodes. Governor, we need to discuss... Elise turned away from Melody. No, Envoy, we do not. I have pulled together a group of our city's best scientists and engineers. I'm going to see if I can stop the slaughter of my people. You can do whatever you want. But just do not interrupt me, or ask for me again. Jai looked over the shoulder of the Pelican's pilot as the vessel swept quickly around the crater's rim. Piles of rubble had slid down, filling in some of the center after the scores of thermobaric explosives that the Sorakans had rigged all around the excavation pit had gone off at once. The blast was incredibly powerful, stemming the constant tide of Sharkoi for a moment. Damn, the pilot said, briefly awed. Forms struggled slowly out of the debris. Many of the Sharkoi had been stunned for the moment by the explosion, but were getting back on their feet. Many didn't move, however, and remained scattered around the edges of the crater and tossed in between buildings. The ones that lived all began to walk unsteadily back toward the crater's center and the entryway down into the Forerunner structure, the very place to where Hecabe had fled. More and more of them trickled out from streets or crawled out from under rubble. Some of them began dragging machinery with them for purposes unknown. They turned their backs to the Sorakan militia, which had previously been their sole focus, to begin digging through a fresh pile of rubble at the center of the pit. Did that blast destroy the Forerunner facility below ground? Rajka asked from the back of the Pelican. Jai could see the glint of the spire still intact. Forerunner. That probably meant that it was buried, but no doubt just fine. Forerunner materials had absurd resiliency. No, it'd take a nuke to cause damage to that thing. Those bombs did help. They bought us time, he responded, as the translation software converted his words into Sangheili. Then let us use that time well, Rajka replied. Chapter 21 The envoy was waiting for Rajka when the lift came to a stop with a heavy jerk as they returned to the underground control center, deep under Soraka. Rajka walked between the Spartans and toward her. How strange that he could move so easily in the Demon Three's midst, without wanting to kill them right then and there. Kaidan, Melody said, rushing toward him, while the Spartans peeled off for the armory. Rajka felt a wave of weariness sweep over him at the reference. He was Kaidan of a people that were still very much alive back in Rak. He had been counting on his death for the past few days, but it hadn't come. Not yet. He still had to be Kaidan, and think like a Kaidan. Everything was at risk. Everything he had tried to create here. He wondered about his bloodline, clan, and kin.
Would they survive?
He even wondered if his carefully tended gardens around the cool waters of the Astelhitch River would burn. Whether the columns of the keep would be pushed over and buried. She called him Kaidon, as if he truly ruled anything.